Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to Raphael Baer and George Eaton about Scotland and the Crimea. Ed Smith will be joining us to talk about shouty politics and Prime Minister's questions. And then Raphael Baer will be interviewing Ivan Lewis, the Shadow Northern Ireland Secretary. I'm joined by our political editor Raphael Baer and George Eaton, editor of The Staggers. And first we're going to talk about Scotland. Earlier this week we had a New Statesman lecture by Alex Salmond, the First Minister, in which he talked about Scotland's future in Scotland's hands. George, you asked him a question afterwards, which I thought was really interesting, about the 50p tax rate. And basically he said that, you know, he wouldn't pledge to reintroduce it, and because he needed Scotland's economy to be competitive. And how interesting was that in terms of where he positions himself as a kind of as a left-wing person rather than a nationalist politician?
Yeah, it's interesting because I pointed out to him, you spoke a lot in your speech about social justice, about how Scotland could pursue a more progressive approach than Westminster, therefore do you support the 50p rate? And his belief is that Scotland would need to support policies such as a low level of income tax and a lower level of corporation tax to attract business investments away from London. But this obviously goes down very badly with the left of his party, who wants Scottish independence precisely so that they can have a higher level of income tax than Westminster and probably tax corporations more rather than less.
It's interesting, the tone of some of what he says on this. I mean, it's not a million miles away from a kind of New Labour proposition, isn't it? Where essentially you say we need to be sort of lean and dynamic and competitive within the framework of a sort of globalised free market world economy, especially a small, newly independent country has to be able to sort of undercut rivals with its tax regime. But at the same time, somehow we'll triangulate that by also having a progressive vision and through, you know, public service reform. He talks about this childcare plan that they have, which would ultimately also make it a fairer society. And he sort of hinted a more equal one. Now, whether or not those two things can actually be done at the same time is one of the big dilemmas of progressive politics. But I don't think he'd ever dare call it sort of Blairite in public. But it's not a million miles away. Yeah,
it's reminiscent of that.
Yeah. So, yeah, orthodox, sort of brown, stealthy progressivism with a bit of genuflection to kind of global finance.
But, Raph, I don't know what you thought of this, the idea about where Scottish independence or more likely, you know, devolution max or some form of greater powers, where does that leave the north of England?
Geographically, it will probably still be pretty much where, yeah, where it always was. But let's say there's a land grab and the border moves stuff. But there's at the moment,
but
no,
you say that. But
that
a lot of the letters that we had in this week were from people in the north of England going, like, if you're going to have this breakaway, more left wing government, take us with you.
Well, this is very interesting. I mean, because underneath all of this is the sense that what Alex Salmond's political project is predicated on very strongly over the next year, 18 months, is the sense that there are parts of the country, parts of the United Kingdom, but Scotland sort of chief among them, where people just really don't vote for the Conservative Party. And the sense that the Conservative Party speaks for, governs on behalf of, represents the slightly more affluent and a culturally fairly distinct southeast of England, and then also to an extent, London as the engine of economic power rather than culturally. The capital's quite, but it's labour quite a lot. But and so you can see how if you then have a new locus of power north of the border in Scotland with Edinburgh as an independent capital city, or a much more devolved administration, then that there is this sort of political valley in the north of England where a Westminster government wouldn't cut through to it, wouldn't speak on behalf of it, or wouldn't govern on behalf of it because there's so many safe Labour seats. And although we wish it weren't that cynical, the reality is, particularly in the run-up to an election, the goodies that the Treasury can give out and the benefits that the Treasury tries to bestow on parts of the country will go to places that they think the Conservatives think they can win, and that's not the north of England.
But don't you think that's becoming a kind of more and more a sort of sub-theme of politics? You saw it very clearly over the floods about the feeling that if this had been happening in Surrey, it would never have been allowed to go on so long. And the same thing that any kind of feeling about the recovery from the recession, about the fact that, London, we hear all these great stories about, house prices are booming. They're not everywhere.
And I think you're absolutely right. This is such an important feature of politics at the moment. And it was something a Labour shadow cabinet minister said to me not that long ago, that actually the loss of southern seats to the Labour Party means that they are not getting fed back to them a lot of important feedback about actually what people's concerns are. So, for example, the Parliamentary Labour Party at the moment can really tell itself with a lot of conviction that the most pressing thing it needs to do is take on the bedroom tax, and the bedroom tax is a terrible policy and it's right for the Labour Party to want to do something about it. But the reality is there are lots of places where there used to be Labour MPs after 1997 and 2001 and even after 2005, where had there still been Labour MPs there now, they would be saying, yeah, okay, look, actually in my part of the world people aren't even noticing the bedroom tax, don't care about it, and actually buy into a Conservative narrative on benefits. And to expand our interest further in the country, we need to be listening to those people. And likewise, the Conservatives, they're not getting the right feedback from constituencies where they don't have a presence. And so politics is stuck, we've talked about this before, but that is a geographical and a constituency thing.
And George, how good do you think the Westminster response to Salmond has been so far? I mean, we talked about the idea about them playing their kind of big cards really early. We're gonna have to break up, we can't have a currency union, that won't work, that kind of thing. Have they got anything left in the locker, or have is there going to be a resurgence of Salmond now, because he's trading quite badly in the polls?
He is, and I certainly think that they'll be defeated, and probably by a double-digit margin, I think. I don't think it's going to be as close as some suggest, because I think all the fundamentals, the economy and the currency questions, are against him, and most people think that they'll be worse off under Scottish independence.
But this comes back to something we said before about the 2012 US election, about the fact that everyone has to pretend that it's really close, because then you can talk about it, there's a more exciting narrative, I guess.
There is, and actually a lot of people won't look at the polls, won't look at the average, they'll just take the individual poll that confirms their prejudices and write that up. I think the challenge is, you've had the sort of united front from Westminster. I can understand that strategy, why they did that on the currency, because the message was that whichever party's in power, you're not going to have the pound. I think the challenge for Labour in particular is to say, actually, look, you don't need Scotland to become independent, to become a more progressive country, because Labour would pursue a more progressive approach in all the areas that you've been unhappy with before: foreign policy, welfare policy, tax, and so on.
That's a very important point, and it's the Scottish Labour conference coming up at the end of this month, I think, and my understanding is that Ed Miliband will try to get that message across. I think that there is, if it is true, and I'm inclined to agree with George, that ultimately you just look at the long-term data trend, there just aren't enough people who want Scotland to be independent, to vote for Scottish independence. And it is also true that every time David Cameron goes north of the border, it does the SNP a favour, because people just hate the Tories. What do you have? You have a situation where the union will be saved, but it's not going to be the Prime Minister that saved it. Well, that kind of creates a vacancy for a politician who can essentially, the crown is on the table, crown being the politician who basically saved the union. And you can see, I'm aware that in Ed Miliband's office, they're thinking, oh, that's a crown that Ed Miliband might plausibly, I'm not saying he will, but might just about plausibly take and try and put on his head.
And he'll come out in a big pair of saltire checked trousers. And he'll be acclaimed as a god.
Yeah, I'm sure he could just read. I'm sure he's got more than one of those in his wardrobe at home.
But to pivot slightly, Raph, you wrote a very fierce column this week, actually, about David Cameron and the coalition conservative-led foreign policy. Just tell me what your essential thesis was there.
Well, the argument broadly is that, you know, in the context of what we've seen happen in Ukraine and Crimea, that there is obviously an enormous challenge facing the Britain's role in the world. You know, we have the attributes of a great power in terms of still a big economy, nuclear weapons, you know, leading role in NATO, the European Union. These are all sort of carried over from the 20th century, so it's not entirely obvious, or at least you need quite some sophisticated account of how that should sustain itself in the 21st century, if indeed that's what we want to do. And you are sort of being as dispassionate as you can, you have to sort of give up on expecting David Cameron to actually articulate that, because all the evidence suggests, from what we've seen so far, that he doesn't, as I wrote, he doesn't like to dwell on perplexing things. I mean, he is he's essentially a dilettante, and his entire political project, both he and George Osborne, has been predicated on making political debate in this country as parochial as possible and simplifying everything. You know, I use the example of a sort of a global economic crisis that involved, you know, massive imbalances between China and the US.
Becomes Labour spent all the money.
Yeah, and systemic risk and market failure becomes Labour threw away a load of money on scroungers getting, you know, job seekers' allowance. You know, it's...
Or treating the EU renegotiations purely as an appeasement.
As a way of managing the Conservative Party, and not having the courage to say the single market is an engine of prosperity for everyone in the European Union, including Britain, and actually enterprising migrants coming here to this country to work is good for the economy, and it is also equivalently good that British people have the opportunity to go and work in other Europe. I mean, that's the Treasury doesn't dispute that argument. The Treasury believes, George Osborne knows that is true. He just recognises this political advantage in sort of gaming a slightly protectionist, reactionary, anti-immigration language in a campaign, and it's shabby. And ultimately, it contributes to this sense that Britain doesn't really want to engage with the question of what its place is in the world, because ultimately, you look at David Cameron and George Osborne, you can't answer the question, why do they want power, other than, I think I called it, the sort of the recreational pleasure of winning. And that's not a good enough reason.
And George, where do you think, I mean, how do you think Labour have played the Ukraine crisis? Do you think it has been a moment where Ed Miliband has looked like he could be a sort of statesman in waiting?
Well, I think they had a quite good start, because some Conservative ministers were idiotic enough to try and basically blame him for it, blame his failure to support military intervention in Syria for
yes, thus inviting the obvious rejoinder that David Cameron called a vote that he knew that, you know, he didn't know that he could win, and then had sort of went, well, in that case, I'm taking my ball home. I'm not playing. Yeah.
Yesterday's PMQs, as you'd expect, was very consensual, Miliband being very statesmanlike. His final question wasn't actually a question at all. He just said, you know, the government will have our full support at this dangerous moment for the world, all very bipartisan. But I think that consensus masks the potential for some quite significant differences over the over whether there should be trade sanctions and asset freezes and how tough they should be, because you can see a difference, you know, of emphasis between sort of Conservatives who are concerned with protecting business interests and protecting the City of London, there's a lot of Russian money in London, and Labour internationalists who say, you know, we must not put profit before
and
people.
I don't think we can be, let's not pretend that Labour isn't divided over any big foreign policy question, and that is the legacy of Blair and Blairism. I mean, the ultimately, you know, it was, I agree, it was completely facile and vacuous, some of those attacks that you had on Ed Miliband over the vote on Syria, somehow signalling that Putin could feel free to go and annex Crimea. It is also true that the Labour leadership does not like to strike conspicuous poses in any big foreign policy question, because every time you do, you're going to have a bunch of people in the PLP and elsewhere in the Labour Party who just love having good old ding-dong over whether or not Tony Blair is a war criminal or a messiah. And it's tedious for the leadership, it's bad for the Labour Party, and they don't want to have that conversation, so they don't.
And on that note, I think we'll probably leave it. Thank you very much, George and Raph.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast on the road, the occasional segment when we actually get out of the office and meet the people who make the decisions in politics rather than the people who wibble on about the decisions in politics from the comfort of a journalist's desk. In that context, I'm honoured to be joined by the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Ivan Lewis, from his magnificent office in Westminster with a view of the Shard and the London Eye. Ivan,
I'm of a generation for whom Northern Ireland was in the news every week, every day. It was one of the most pressing issues. Then, mercifully, for all the right reasons, the salience of it dropped right down. Last week, we had this case of a suspect in a terrorism trial who walked away from court because it transpired. He had had a letter of assurance that he was no longer considered on the run. And this obviously reopened a lot of wounds and left a lot of people very angry. So just from the opposition's point of view, are you satisfied now with the way this has been handled?
Yeah, we fully support the inquiry that David Cameron has established. I think the first thing to say about Northern Ireland that we should always remember is the tremendous progress that has been made over the last 15 years. But it's true that this judgment came in the context of a very difficult year, a lot of fragility, an increase in the activity of dissident terrorists that poses a real threat to security, loyalist protests around decisions about flying flags, about parades. So the judgment last week came in that context of a situation where people are increasingly concerned about peace and stability in Northern Ireland.
To what extent is this, do you think, connected to economic optimism? Because there was a period, obviously, when you had a peace dividend that people talked about in relation to Northern Ireland, also picking up a little bit of traction from what, you know, we referred to when it was fashionable to do so as the sort of Celtic Tiger phenomenon in the Republic. These factors are now spent a little bit, aren't they? And presumably that is going to be something that is feeding to a high level of youth unemployment. You're going to have a lot of angry young men on the streets of Northern Ireland who could feasibly be susceptible to a kind of new generation of political radicalisation.
I think you're absolutely right. When the Good Friday Agreement was signed, youth unemployment in Northern Ireland was down at 9%. It's now up at 22%. That is a stark illustration of the challenges that we face. Of course, a sense of social exclusion, alienation, fuels the tensions and the strains that exist. And that's across the community divide. So if people don't see any prospect of employment, there's intergenerational deprivation that passes from one generation to the next, there is insufficient jobs. All of that fuels a question mark about what is the benefits of this peace process for me, my family and my immediate community. And that's why, whilst all of the emphasis in Northern Ireland often is around political issues and the past, those things are incredibly important. Actually, the issue that will really change things generationally in Northern Ireland is jobs, is education.
OK, well, let's move range then back to mainland UK then, because I think you've made the case, rightly, that it's such exceptional circumstances in Northern Ireland. But those same questions, welfare reform, public sector reform, these are going to be huge challenges for a Labour government if it comes in 2015, sort of irrespective of what the fiscal, the exact fiscal timetable of what the Labour administration would be expected to do. So, you know, you've written for the New Statesman about what a Labour agenda for reform of the economy, reform of the state would be. How do you see that now progressing as part of Labour's offer?
Well, I think it's absolutely central. We've got to have a situation where, if you like, what we have from this government is ideologically is a withered state with a view that somehow the big society will move in and rescue communities and the country. That clearly is not working. It's extraordinary that we no longer hear two words in any of David Cameron's speeches, and that's the big society. This was this man's big idea. And that demonstrates that his failure to detoxify the Tory brand is a major problem for the Conservative Party. But from Labour's point of view, there is no doubt that towards our end, the end of period we were in government,
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What's the sense that we only ever talked about the state and the market? And we talked often about an over-centralised state. We gave the impression that everything could be changed from Westminster and Whitehall. And in my view, we have to move away from that. We have to recognise that, first of all, we'll have to do more with less. That is the reality in terms of the fiscal climate.
Do you think that has been fully understood by the rest of the Labour Party? I mean, it's still quite a contentious thing to say. I've been to Labour conferences, Fabian conferences. You get there's some serious bridling at that assertion still.
Well, it's reality, and I think it's very, very important that Ed Miliband and Ed Balls have made that very, very clear. One of the regrets I have about our period in office is we didn't talk about community and family anywhere near as much as we should have done. As I say, we talked about government, we talked about the market.
Why family? What do you mean? Because the politics of family is still often seen through the prism of whether certain models of family life are somehow sort of morally better than others or socially desirable. So what might Labour have said about family that it didn't say?
Well, first of all, it isn't making judgments about the nature of families or the shape of families. It's recognising what matters to people. If you're going to be relevant in a world where people are increasingly cynical about politics, what matters to people? What matters to people is their family. It's their job. It's the neighbourhood that they live in. If politicians don't speak in that language and don't recognise that many of the things that are about improving people's not just standard of living in the context of the standard of living crisis, but also improving people's quality of life, is the interaction between government and family and community,
I
then you miss the point.
Yeah, but now I understand that.
If it's just a transaction between the state and the individual.
But this gets us into the territory. I mean, and I followed with interest, great interest Ed Miliband's, the Hugo Young lecture, talking about the relational state and changing the culture of the way that government is delivered. The bit that was missing for me from that analysis is where it says the way, you know, what kind of state delivery that happens now will have to change. In other words, actually,
I'll give two examples to help.
Yeah.
And I'm not announcing Labour Party policy now, because Ed Balls will not be very happy. But I'll give two examples. There are two big issues, big challenges that face society. One is the educational underperformance of children, particularly children from disadvantaged backgrounds. All of the solutions over the years about that has been about the quality of leadership of schools, about the curriculum, about teaching. All of those things matter massively. But what also matters, particularly for the most disadvantaged young people, is they don't have one trusted adult in their life. Not one trusted adult. They go home and there isn't anybody who cares about education or even relates to it. Why couldn't we galvanise the thousands of people out there who would love to mentor young people in that situation? That isn't about a massively, largely funded state programme. It's about galvanising the potential of citizens who would want to make a difference to that whole range of young people who currently underperform educationally, and we pay a heavy price for that. The second example, one of the great challenges facing our society is the ageing society. And the debate often is about how are you going to pay for long-term care. These are very, very difficult issues. Andy Burnham, absolutely right to talk about integrating health and social care. But actually, one of the biggest single factors in terms of the ageing society is loneliness and isolation. Again, there are large numbers of people out there who would not have to be, in fact, shouldn't be paid professionals, paid social workers, paid care providers, who would be more than happy to take responsibility for supporting an isolated, lonely older person. Now, so it's not always reaching for the state solution. It's the state recognising the scale of some of those challenges.
Okay, last question. This, as we've said, you know, was the theme of a big speech that Ed Miliband made recently. One of the criticisms that is sometimes made is that, you know, Ed will say these things and they are ticked off part of the agenda, but actually you don't necessarily have confidence that it will be sustained as a story, and Labour's account of what it plans to do will move on to something else. Because, as we've just been saying, there are so many potential obstacles to this. It's the sort of thing that has to be embarked on in the first 100 days of a Labour government, isn't it?
I'll never forget the meeting that I had with Ed, the first meeting I had with Ed after he became leader and I'd been appointed to the Shadow Cabinet. We had a 2.5-hour meeting. And the passionate part of Ed that was really, really good at that meeting was when he talked about his commitment to a new state. He doesn't believe in an over-centralised, top-down state. He is as passionate about that as he is about the need to create a new economy which works for the many, not just a few at the top. And to be honest, there is a debate about how we fight the next election. There are some people who would argue that we fight it on a very narrow prospectus. My view is if we fight it on a very, very narrow perspective, it's going to be incredibly difficult to enthuse and persuade people that they want change. The danger is they would stick with status quo. I believe We've got to focus on the cost of living crisis, where people know there is a big disparity between their everyday lives and what the government says about economic recovery. But equally, we've got to focus on what kind of community, what kind of society do you and your family want to live in? And if we're able to do that, I think we'll be able to do what's crucially important if Labour is to win. We have to reassure people where they have doubts about us. On economic credibility, on immigration, on welfare. They have anxieties. We have to reassure them. But we also have to be the people that give people a sense of optimism and hope that it doesn't need to be like this. This country can have a better future.
Right, and
now, the example I always give of this is the covenant that has always existed in our society. And that covenant is your kids and your grandkids always do better than you do. At the moment, that covenant has never been a greater risk. And I think a Labour Party that can demonstrate to people we are determined to restore that covenant will actually resonate with a significant number of people who still need to be persuading to vote for us at the next election.
So you would reject the idea that is around, and I've obviously picked up and have written about, that that's all well and good, but the reality is it comes down to if enough Tories vote UKIP and you hang on to your Lib Dem switches, you're going to nab those crucial seats in the Midlands and you'll get over the line. That is the counter-narrative to the one you've just given, that actually the reality of how Ed Miliband becomes Prime Minister is in the numbers.
I don't think that that is correct. Ed Miliband will become Prime Minister as a result of doing two things. One is reassuring people where they have doubts. He's been very clear about saying that there were elements of our immigration policy that should have been different. For example, he and Ed Balls have been very clear about saying that there will have to be a very tough approach to fiscal responsibility. So there is an understanding, and Rachel Reeves has been very clear about the fact that the social security system, welfare, has to be reformed, although we don't support some of the reforms of the current government. But alongside that, the work that John Cruddas is doing on the policy review, the speech that Ed made recently on our commitment to people power, of devolving power and empowering communities, of changing the role of the state, all of that is about what kind of society and what kind of country do you want to live in? And I think the Labour Party can win that argument, and I think it can win it convincingly. People do ask questions about their quality of life, as well as their cost of living. And I think it's those two things coming together that will give Labour a message that will be very, very compelling coming into the election.
Okay, Ivan, thanks very much. That's plenty of good chatter for our most dedicated podcast listeners. Thanks very much.
That was Raphael Baer interviewing Ivan Lewis. And if you'd like to hear more about the relational state, and frankly, why wouldn't you, you can log on to our website at newstatesman.com/podcast for a full version of that interview. I'm joined by our political editor, Raphael Baer, and our columnist, Ed Smith, to talk about civility and space. So, Ed, you wrote your column this week basically around the thesis about why the House of Commons chamber is so shouty and two benches sitting opposite each other. You mentioned the fact there's not enough seats for all the MPs to sit at the time. Do you like shouty politics, or do you personally find it off-putting?
I don't warm to it, no, and I think lots of people don't. I think we underestimate the extent to which the few little TV clips of Prime Minister's questions is actually, for many people, all the politics they'll consume in that week. And I think many people find the tone and the manner of it very off-putting. I understand that politics is by definition adversarial to a degree, and of course there's a great tradition of parliamentary democracy in this country. However, I don't think that necessarily supports an unthinking conservatism, that there's something about the layout of our house that somehow makes us a wonderfully mature democracy. I think we can do a lot better.
There's some interesting research came out quite recently, I think by the Hansard Society, on quite the extent to which people despise Prime Minister's questions, think it makes politicians look like children, like idiots. The data were shocking, actually, in terms of how badly people came across. And I mean, my sense is that the MPs themselves are quite divided over this. I recently had one shadow cabinet minister say to me that at PMQs, as they call it,
She feels physically sick and it struggles to not just get up and walk out because it's so vile, the sort of the atmosphere. But I've also had front bench politician say, that's the deal. If you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. And this is actually, it is a crucible in which bluff, nonsense, and other weakness is found out very quickly, and that's quite good for democracy. But it's got out of control, I think.
That's the tension, isn't it? Between you don't want everyone sitting around in soggy consensus, sort of droning on you. So you talk about this idea about people giving long, boring speeches. But you, Ed, say that that's not the problem. No one, when professionalisation of politics means people don't give boring speeches, really.
Sure, the hero of the Let's Not Touch the Chamber is obviously Winston Churchill, who played a decisive hand in 1943 when the Commons was bombed, and he argued that the reasons why the Commons should be rebuilt in the same form with the same shape was that he despised the sort of horseshoe consensual, he probably had Borgen in mind even though the TV series wasn't around then, and secondly that there was something wonderful about a cramped house that worked against long speeches. Long speeches aren't the problem now. The problem is shoutiness, and no one can actually be, an idea is not allowed to break out. What really interests me is that I think both the Conservative and Labour leader, I think instinctively, and I think this is not just posturing, don't like it that much. And I think in an ideal world they would change it, but there's always a problem with being the one that's perceived as looking like you can't take
exactly.
it.
Exactly, it's a zero-sum game, isn't it? If one person sort of agrees to be quiet and sensible and consensual, then they're potentially giving the upper hand to whoever is going to be going to sort of steal the opportunity to make a really pointed and aggressive partisan attack, because in the idiom of British politics that looks strong and being quiet and accommodating looks weak. But my sense is that it's got worse because of an interaction between the sort of shouty, adversarial, combative style and the desperate narrowing of the parameters of what MPs are allowed to say. So if you could be with a great rhetorical flourish, say something original in that idiom, it would be quite effective. But if you combine a narrowing of message, so there's only about 7 words which encapsulate what you are permitted to say and make it shouty, those two things together really make it playground insults.
I think there are other things that we don't talk about very often either. So I went to the Scottish Parliament recently and I was surprised by how great the disabled access is in it. And this is a real problem. The lobby room is almost, I don't know how you would get to it if you were in a wheelchair, for example. And there are huge problems
it's
not easily
right
navigable, is it? But for anybody who isn't very mobile. And this is a general, I think there's a wider problem, but when I go, which I don't do very often, into Parliament, it feels like this is somewhere that is much more comfortable for people who've been to a private school with cloisters. You know, they've been to Oxford, they've been to an Inns of Court. I think there is a certain feeling about a certain type of person will feel more comfortable there than others.
I think that's true. And I also think that's a problem with the way politics is perceived. I think that it kind of makes a certain type of man look all too at home, actually, which is not, I don't think, a good message for politics as a whole. So the people who should really be calling for reformation of the House actually are people who probably are shown to be close to being a caricature when they're in it, ironically. I think that people who switch on the television and they see a certain type of pinstripe suit and a certain type of tie and a certain type of shouting and paper waving, that doesn't do democracy, I don't think, in this country any good at all.
There is certainly also a problem, and it does come from that culture, the way a certain kind of establishment complacency is sort of in the upholstery of the place. That there is a perception of what constitutes a good parliamentarian as opposed to what constitutes a good lawmaker. And there are people who have quite good careers in Westminster by gaming Parliament very effectively, whether it's with the well-crafted amendment or at the timing of when you introduce an amendment or what you do with your various different 3-minute rules and the rest of it, and talking things out and all that sort of stuff. That is parlour game politics. It can be quite effective in Westminster, and it can really raise someone's stature in that tiny idiom of SW1. It doesn't make better laws, it doesn't make better government.
Would you do anything about it if you could? If Parliament, heaven forfend, burnt to the ground, would you rebuild it like it is now? Would you rebuild it in a horseshoe with, lovely pine wood, make it a bit Borgen.
You've made that easier for me. I certainly would rebuild it differently in the event of it needing to be rebuilt. The difficult thing is that, you know, starting from where we're at, I can't see a parliament easily voting for more money for a new type yes, of debating chamber. Yeah. But yes, I think actually as a kind of medium term, if you like, if I was at Parliament, at the back of my collective mind, I'd be thinking, when an opportunity does arise, let's have a different atmosphere. And I think it actually would make a difference. I think Churchill was absolutely right when he said we shape buildings and buildings shape us, just not in the way he meant. Mm. And I think it would actually be good all round in every respect for the manner, for the mood, for the visual image of politics, if we had a slightly more modern, or significantly yeah. more modern.
I'd come at it, I'm inclined to agree with that, but I'd come at it at a slightly different angle. I don't think it will change until we have the culture changes that allows MPs and politicians to speak their mind without fear of gaffe or going off message. And if you had more freedom to actually express yourself in all sorts of forums, there wouldn't be this sort of concentration, this sort of pressure cooker that means the few expressions that are permitted come out that bellowing volume.
Following your own logic, we in the media have a role to play there.
Absolutely.
When people do make mistakes, yeah. and they're just mistakes, they're not meaningful yeah. mistakes, they're just silly mistakes.
When plainly you know what he meant, then let's why just call not? It yeah, that. Just call it that. Yeah, exactly.
But I wonder if, maybe this is a utopian dream of the idea that we'll go through, you know, gaff-tastic coverage and out the other side. There'll come a point where people are just bored of constant fishing for gas, I think you called it once, right?
You'd hope so, but social media has created such a new fertile terrain for, you know, mm-hmm. what he or she said on Twitter, what he or she posted on their Facebook page. I'm afraid gaff fishing, you know, there's oceans to be trawled before that.
On that depressing note, I will say thank you very much to Ed and Raph.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. The podcast is produced by Philip Morn, and our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.